Die Vereinigten Staaten sind für Deutschland so wichtig wie kaum ein anderes Land auf der Welt. Als Handelspartner, als Verbündeter, aber auch in historischer und kultureller Hinsicht. Im 18. und 19. Jahrhundert wanderten unzählige Menschen in die USA aus, auch aus dem heutigen Saarland und der Großregion. Einer der berüchtigsten Nachkommen eines saarländischen Auswanderers war zum Beispiel der Gangster John Dillinger, der unter anderem dafür sorgte, dass das FBI eine Liste mit den meistgesuchtesten Verbrechern in den USA einführte und ihn natürlich prompt ganz nach oben setzte. Ein anderes Beispiel ist der amerikanische General und spätere US-Präsident Eisenhower. Der konnte seine Familie auch ins Saarland bis nach Karlsbrunn im Warnd zurückverfolgen. Die Beziehungen zwischen Deutschland und den USA sind nicht nur in dieser Beziehung, sondern nach wie vor eng und sie sind wichtig für beide Staaten. Damit diese Freundschaft lebendig bleibt, sorgen zum Beispiel Diplomaten auf beiden Seiten des Atlantiks für die beste Grundlage. Hallo, mein Name ist Dominik Holl, ich arbeite für die Union Stiftung und darf Sie herzlich zu einer neuen und außergewöhnlichen Folge von Politik International begrüßen. Zusammen mit der Konrad-Adenauer-Stiftung Saarbrücken, dem Deutsch-Amerikanischen Institut Saarland und dem Deutschen Orient-Institut in Berlin schauen wir alle zwei Wochen auf ein globales Thema. Ich spreche heute mit einem, der von Frankfurt aus als Diplomat die deutsch-amerikanischen Beziehungen über mehrere Jahre hin intensiv gepflegt hat. Der US-Generalkonsul Norman Thatcher Sharpe. Er verlässt Deutschland im Juli und ich habe das zum Anlass genommen, mit ihm zu sprechen. Das Interview habe ich mit ihm auf Englisch geführt. Da ich es während einer Reise aufgenommen habe, ist die Tonqualität bei meinen Fragen leider nicht so gut. Dafür ist der Generalkonsul umso besser zu verstehen. Ich möchte mich bei dem Deutsch-Amerikanischen Institut für den Kontakt zum Generalkonsulat bedanken. Und wenn Sie mehr über das Deutsch-Amerikanische Institut oder die Arbeit des Generalkonsulats in Frankfurt wissen möchten, dann finden Sie in den Shownotes die entsprechenden Links zu den jeweiligen Homepages. And off we go.
Today I'm talking with one of the highest representatives of the government of the United States of America in Germany, Consul General in Frankfurt, Norman Thatcher Sharpe. Hello, sir. Thank you for being here. It's a very pleasure talking to you, even if it's via Zoom. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for doing it. I'm really grateful for the opportunity to do this today. Thank you.
Mr. Sharpe, first things first, how does one become Consul General? Did you simply apply after school, or how did you become to the position where you are right now?
Well, I've been a career U.S. diplomat for 31 years now. And throughout our career, assignments are assigned on a competitive basis through a selection process. And for this particular position here in Frankfurt, which is one of the most senior positions we have in our diplomatic service, I was bidding coming out of a job in Washington. And I think that I was able to explain to the decision makers that my candidacy, I brought a lot to the position through my candidacy, through my extensive experience elsewhere in Europe, six previous European countries I had worked in, and my experience leading large teams.
That's very fascinating, and we will talk about your experience a little bit more soon, but let's go back a little bit further than that even. You grew up in Washington, D.C., the heart of the U.S. government in terms of politics. And how is Washington, D.C. different from other cities, other big cities in the United States? Is it very different? Is it the same? Or can you feel that there's the beating heart of politics in the United States?
Well, it is home to the federal government and all its three branches. So you do get the feeling that this is the capital of the country where important decisions are being made. Washington, though, is also host to a huge international community. Most countries around the world have either their largest or one of their largest embassies in the world in Washington, D.C. And then we also have the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that are based there. So Washington, in addition to being a center of U.S. politics, is really a very global international city also. And then I'm biased, of course, because I grew up there, but I will say that Washington is a very green city. Rock Creek Park, which is the third oldest national park in the United States, in one of our largest city parks in the United States, runs right through the middle of Washington, D.C. And then the other thing I always tell potential visitors is that we have one of the best networks of museums in the world, the Smithsonian, that has 21 different museums specializing in everything from art from around the world to history to air and space technology, a zoo, et cetera. And they all have free entry.
That is true. I had the pleasure to go to visit Washington twice so far, and going to the museums, just walk in there and enjoy all the exhibits. It's really amazing. I simply can agree with that. But back to you and your career. You went to college, and then you have a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Pennsylvania. Why did you choose economics at first? What plans did you have as a student? What did you want to become one day?
So unlike a lot of people, I think, that live in Washington, D.C., my father did not work for the U.S. government, actually, and nor was he a lawyer. He was actually an entrepreneur and a businessman. And he encouraged me to study economics at university in order to better understand how the world has been able to progress over the centuries. He was a strong believer in the power of free markets and the ability they have to drive innovation and prosperity in the United States and around the world. So that's why I chose economics. Regarding my plans, well, I went to university on a scholarship, a stipendium from the U.S. Navy. And so the Navy paid for my 4 years of undergraduate study. And then in return, my agreement was to serve 4 years as an officer in the U.S. Navy. So my intention was to serve those 4 years, fulfill my commitment, and then do something out in the business world.
Very fascinating. We will talk about your career in the Navy a little bit more soon. But first, let's go on. After you graduated economics and the University of Pennsylvania, you then graduated in National Security Resource Strategy from the National Defense University. What drew you to that particular field of research? Was it your time in the Navy that you got more interested in national security and defense, or was it something very different that drew you to this particular field of science?
Well, I think that the key point here is that in my case, there was actually a 25-year gap between when I completed my bachelor's degree and when I started my master's degree. So I had been out of school for a long time before I went back to get my master's degree. I was very fortunate that our State Department, our foreign ministry, if you will, sends about 40 U.S. mid to senior level diplomats per year to the senior military training colleges that are operated by the Department of Defense for training their Army colonels and Navy captains and other senior officers. And so we have this exchange program. So I was very intrigued by the possibility of doing that because of I'm a firm believer in the power of the whole of government working together, diplomacy arm in arm with development specialists, with the military, all working together. And so I applied for this opportunity and was accepted. And this was the degree that they offered. And I thought it worked well with my background in economics. And it was quite an amazing opportunity to spend a year getting a master's degree in national security resource strategy with all these senior military officers and other diplomats.
That does sound very fascinating, and respect for the going back to school after such a long term must have been pretty hard to get back in the flow, I imagine.
Yeah, the first day we were there, the president of the university had a big meeting for all of us in an auditorium, and they asked us to put up our hands if we had been out of school for more than if the last time we had attended, academic school was more than 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15, 20. By the time they got to 25, I was one of the few people still had my hand in the air. So, but I was happy to have the opportunity also on a personal level, because before that, my wife had been the only person in our family who had a master's degree. And now I was able to say, I have a master's degree also like you.
So you caught up to your wife. That's wonderful.
It took about 5 years.
Hey, it's never too late. A few weeks back, you visited Saarbrücken, and I was very pleased to have been invited to join you for a bike tour along the Saar, our river. And at a lock a little way up the river, you told us about your time in the Navy when you were stationed in Panama, where they also have quite a lot of locks, much bigger than the one we have at the Saar. What was that like? What was your time in the Navy stationed in Panama? And aside from that, what was it like, being in the Navy?
Well, I served on two ships before I went to Panama, two shipboard assignments as the navigator and communications officer on a guided missile destroyer, and then as the propulsion engineer on a non-nuclear powered aircraft carrier. And both of those had taught me a lot about leading large groups of people around a mission. My assignment in Panama was fundamentally different because I spent my time traveling around South and Central America, organizing military training exercises and professional military exchanges with other navies in Latin America. And in many ways, really, it was a life-changing experience for me, because I think, as I said before in one of your previous questions, my original plan was to do my 4 years in the Navy and get out and go into some kind of the business world in some way. But during my travels around South and Central America, when I was based out of Panama, I found that I really enjoyed representing the United States abroad internationally. I really loved using a foreign language, in that case, mostly Spanish, to communicate. I loved experiencing these new cultures and meeting non-Americans in my travels. And really, because of that job, I decided that instead of going back and maybe getting an MBA or something like that and going into the business world, that experience in Panama was what made me decide to become a U.S. diplomat at the age of 28.
That's very fascinating. But before we talk a little bit more, maybe even about the U.S. Armed Forces, one more question about you and your job. You have German roots, as I'm informed, if I'm informed correctly. And what did you know about Germany before you started as a consul general in Frankfurt? And how has your image of our country changed in the time you've been here?
Well, on a personal note, three of my four grandparents were the children or grandchildren of Germans who left Hesse in Baden-Württemberg in the second half of the 19th century to move to the United States. And I knew that, but I didn't know all the details about my heritage. I was fortunate, though, that I have a second cousin on my mother's side who lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the Scharfs all moved to from Europe and from Germany. And he's a retired lawyer and now very passionate about genealogy. So he very kindly offered to do all the research for me and was really able to go back and find church records and town records and things. Everything is now digitalized online. It's amazing what you can find. And he was able to do a lot of research and really find all three of my branches of my family that come back to Germany. And so because of that, I've been able to visit the places where my ancestors came from. So I visited Waldmannsweiler and Esslingen down in Baden-Württemberg. I visited Flieden up near Fulda in Hesse, and I've visited Schwenningen, Heuberg, down in southern Baden-Württemberg. And those are all, in from each of those places, my ancestors left to go to the United States in the second half of the 19th century.
It's absolutely fascinating. My father grew up in Villingen, Schwenningen, so I know this part of Germany as well.
And I didn't know that there were three Schwenningens. Actually, there's Villingen Schwenningen, there's Schwenningen Heuberg, where my mother's ancestors came from.
Okay.
A small town of about 1,500 people, And then there's also Schwenningen, apparently, in Bavaria, which I have not visited. But to be able to go to these towns in Southwest Germany and visit the places where my ancestors were, you know, baptized, married, where they grew up, to see the records in the city hall or the records of the church, it really brought history to life for me. Of course, I'm not exceptional in that way. You know, 1/6 or 1/7 of the American population has German roots. Germany is the largest source of ancestry for Americans. More Americans have ancestry from Germany than from any other country. And so I didn't realize that before I came here, but being here has really allowed me to delve deeper into these deep and historical ties between the United States and Germany.
So with what kind of image of Germany did you arrive here in Germany? And did this image you had initially when you started working here, in what way did it change?
I mean, Germany has a reputation for precision, quality, the famous German Mittelstand that I think everybody knows about. Germany is well known as a leader economically in Europe. Everywhere I've served in Europe, Germany has been a partner in a lot of the countries where I work, where we were trying to bring countries into the European Union and into NATO, in Poland, in Croatia, in Estonia. Germany has been a partner and mentor for those countries and a role model. At the same time, you know, we've wanted Germany to stand up and contribute more to its defense. And I think that, you know, over the last 3 years that I've been here, you know, very much as a result of Putin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, we've seen in how Germany is now stepping up and really delivering on these leadership that's required militarily and security-wise, commensurate with its economic size.
Was there something that impressed you most, apart from those stereotypes that may be true or may not be true in parts, but what impressed you most when you met the Germans?
You know, I think that the thing that stands out in my mind is really a personal thing. And that goes back to, you know, my visits to my roots. I went down to I've been now several times, this small town of Baldmannsweiler, which is down in Baden-Württemberg near Esslingen, and where my great-great-grandfather, Scharf, was born, and many generations of Scharfs before him had been born and lived there in Baldmannsweiler. He ended up, my great-great-grandfather ended up falling in love with a woman from Esslingen and moving there. And it was in Esslingen that my great-grandfather was born and left Esslingen in 1888 at the age of 17 by himself, if you can imagine that, without family, leaving everything behind, his language, his community, his family, his friends, everything he knew, and going off in search of a better life in this relatively young country called America. And I went down there, and on the wall of the church where the Scharfs had been baptized and married and buried, there's a large plaque on the wall, the outside wall of the church, and it lists all the sons of Baldmannsweiler who died in World War I. And there's four Scharfs listed on that plaque. And you know that those Scharfs must have been cousins of my grandfather, Howard Scharf, who was the first Scharf born in America after my great-grandfather had moved over, and who was sent at the age of 17 to Europe to fight against his father's people, his father's homeland, in World War I. So we had Scharf against Scharf, cousin against cousin. And then for me to come here, you know, two generations after my grandfather was sent over to fight against the Germans and to represent the United States here at a time when the partnership between our countries is so strong and so important on the world stage is really quite a personal honor. And I think that's the memory that I'm always going to keep of my time here.
That's an amazing story. And I think it's it has been quite common. I recently watched the HBO miniseries Band of Brothers about soldiers from the 101st Airborne going on D-Day to Europe. And I think it was the very first or second episode where they are landing in Normandy, and they're capturing some German soldiers, and one of them starts talking in perfect English, and he's from the United States, one who came with the Volkssturm, those Germans who were called home by Hitler to fight, and so he ended up on the other side, the American fighting for the Nazis in Europe, fighting against his brethren from the United States. So yeah, war is crazy. And we will talk a little bit more about more recent conflicts. But first, you mentioned that you got to know Germany as a partner within Europe for other countries. Like you mentioned Estonia, you mentioned Croatia. There's also a great alliance and a great friendship between Germany and the United States. But it has come under pressure in the recent past. So in your opinion, what are the main challenges for the relationship of our two nations right now?
Well, I mean, I think if we look over the past several years, we can see how alliances like this one between the United States and Germany are a tremendous source of strength. They show that our shared values and really our shared morality transcend our national borders. But at the same time, we are in a world where there are competitors and even enemies out there who do not want us to collaborate across the Atlantic. They look for ways to divide us, to divide our partnership. But as we look at these global challenges today, whether we're talking about the existential threat of the climate crisis, or we're talking about protecting our rules-based international order, which I would submit has unlocked tremendous stability and prosperity over the past seven decades. In any of these challenges, we have to continue to cooperate together, and we have to continue to defend our shared values. So I think that we share this fundamental commitment to democracy, to human rights, to the rule of law, and we have to continue to find ways to partner together, because if we partner together, we have the ability to shape the world of the future, a world that's going to be very much influenced by developments in technology and emerging technologies we don't know. But if the United States and Germany work together, Germany in its leading role in Europe, I think we have a tremendous ability to shape the world together in a way that reflects the shared values of ours.
So let's talk about one partnership in particular. Let's talk about NATO and the question of global peace and security that are in a special focus with all the crises and wars going on around us just now. With the base in Ramstein, we have a U.S. military base just an hour away from Saarbrücken. So where do you see the military cooperation? So the cooperation in a very specific field, and that is the military, the armed forces cooperation between the United States and Germany, especially in the context of NATO in the near future. Do you see it also that it's going a particular way that you like, or do you see that there should be some improvements to go on?
Well, I mean, first of all, Germany is the second largest host of U.S. troops of anywhere in the world. So we have almost 40,000 U.S. military service members here, plus their family members. And Germany has been a tremendous host for all of them. And they the work that we've done in particular, just exemplified over the past couple of years, the work that we've done to defend and shore up NATO's eastern flank, the work we've done to support Ukraine, we could not have done without this partnership with Germany and the ability to base our troops here, to train our troops here, to be able to push our troops out to NATO's front lines and to be able to support Ukraine. So that's all thanks to this partnership we have with Germany. That's fantastic. When Putin invaded Ukraine back in February 2022, he thought that he would be able to divide us. And instead, what he's found is NATO's larger than it's ever been. with the recent accession of Finland and NATO. And we're going to meet this summer in Washington to celebrate the NATO's 75th anniversary. And when we meet there, we're going to have more countries. We expect to have more countries than ever before, hopefully 20, contributing the 2% goal that everybody committed to, 2%, spending 2% of GDP on defense that everybody committed to in Wales at the Wales Summit back in 2014. That's the highest number ever. So we've seen how over the past couple of years, NATO has gotten larger, it's gotten more cohesive, it's more prepared, and Germany has been a key part of that. Germany is one of the top three supporters for the Ukraine in its existential struggle for its sovereignty and its freedom in the face of Putin's aggression. And we see how Germany is now investing in interoperability. So I think the military partnership is very strong, and it's getting even stronger daily.
I want to talk a little bit more about corporations and not only focus on the military, but also on this part. When I was invited by the U.S. Embassy and the consulate in Frankfurt to participate in the International Visitors Leadership Program, thanks again for this amazing opportunity, I learned, among many other things, about the state partnership program of the National Guard. And what they explained to us in Iowa was that after Russia invaded the Ukraine, as you mentioned, everybody would call the National Guard in California to get information about what's going on in Ukraine. Because, as they explained us, within the SPP, this partnership program, the partner state of the National Guard in California is the Ukraine. So they train together, they exercise together, they have a very close partnership on a military level. But still, it's very strong, it's deep-rooted contact and exchange. How important for the United States are programs like the SPP between armed forces, but also, on the other hand, exchange programs like the IVLP for their own image, the image of the United States within the world?
So both those programs that you mentioned, and thank you for participating in the IVLP, but both those programs, the State Partnership Program and this International Visitors Leadership Program, both programs we consider vital for advancing international cooperation, enhancing mutual security, and really fostering these very enduring relationships between our countries and between people. So these programs bring people together. The State Partnership Program that you mentioned, you saw in action out in California, engages more than 100 countries in these kinds of partnerships, and it promotes people-to-people diplomacy. It promotes friendship across borders. It lays the groundwork for effective cooperation if a crisis breaks out, for example. It fosters trust and solidarity through these trainings and exercises that they facilitate. And then similarly, the IVLP, which you participated in, that also provides, you know, firsthand experience in the United States. It helps to forge these lasting relationships that will contribute to future transatlantic partnership and cooperation. So the personal connections and the shared expertise that these kinds of programs foster are absolutely vital for addressing the future global challenges that we face out there.
And on a personal note, the IVLP program is an absolute amazing experience. That's been a real pleasure going to the United States for 3 weeks and going to places. I have a visit like Iowa and Nebraska. It was amazing. But there's another way you try to, to engage in the world and to bring people together from the United States and from other countries, in this case, particular Germany. After World War II, the United States built what today are the German-American Institute, the Deutsch-Amerikanische Institute, all over Germany. And we, as a Unionsstiftung, we cooperate closely together with one of those institutes we've got here in the Saarland. And I'm very happy about the work the director, Dr. Bruno von Lutz, is doing. How important are these institutes from your perspective? And what's your expectation from them? So what do you expect from those German-American institutes you established a very long time ago in Germany?
They all of those institutes have a long tradition, like you pointed out, but at the same time, they're not resting on their laurels. They're really at the forefront of innovation and engagement of young people and in promoting our shared values. They support freedom of expression. They exemplify, in many ways, freedom of expression. They help to contribute to a coherent 21st century narrative about democracy and its value. They help to educate and inform citizens about issues that are of transatlantic importance and global importance. And they bring people together. We're fortunate to have six of them in our part of Southwest Germany. So not just our one in Saarbrücken, but also in Kaiserslautern and in Heidelberg, Stuttgart, Tübingen, and in Freiburg. And they are just incredibly important kind of force multipliers for us in our efforts to our diplomatic efforts across Southwest Germany. So we're very fortunate to have as a partner in those institutes, the German government at all levels, at the Bundesebene, the Landebene, and at the city level also. So they're just tremendous partners of ours.
Yeah, and I can also I can only recommend anybody who's listening now to check out the web pages and the offers they're giving. It's just amazing what they are offering to anybody who would like to participate. But now we've talked a lot about international relations. We talked about your and my personal experience between our countries and international relationships with NATO, the SPP, the IVLP, and also like institutes with like the German American Institute. Those are all different elements of one world trying to get along together. But right now, everybody's looking to November, to the presidential elections, and there's a fear that after the election, the United States might isolate itself from the global world and focus only on itself. Do you see that as well? Do you see this tendency of the United States and of its people to isolate itself more? And are there certain initiatives and programs that may be stronger than any isolationist movements and should give hope, even if a more isolationist approach by the United States would happen after November?
Well, first of all, before we look ahead to the November elections, we have a very important election coming up right here in Europe and in Germany on June 9th.
And that's true.
I want to encourage all of your listeners to please get out and vote on June 9th. That participation in democracy is a privilege, but it's also a responsibility. And if we want to keep this experiment in democracy going strong, everybody has to participate. So to your listeners, please get out and vote on June 9th. Looking ahead, you know, if we look at the United States's interconnectedness across the globe, and particularly across the Atlantic, we see how we have these deep-rooted historical alliances. We have these longstanding shared democratic values, and that we are working together on an array of shared global challenges and security issues. And that's not going to change, I don't think, in the near future. If we look at the last 2.5 years, after Putin's full invasion of Ukraine, every time President Biden has gone to the Congress and said, we the United States need to send another assistance or support package to Ukraine, every single one of those proposals from President Biden has passed, been approved by the U.S. Congress in a bipartisan way. And I think that's a strong sign of the bipartisan support around U.S. foreign policy goals. And then let's talk about economic prosperity on both sides of the Atlantic. We just saw the trade data. I don't know if you saw that on Friday, that the U.S. is now Germany's number one trading partner in the world. the U.S. is the number one source of foreign direct investment into the United States. So we see how these the prosperity of our citizens on both sides of the Atlantic is interlinked in so many ways. And I don't expect that's going to change. These ties are so deep economically and investment and trade-wise, and our ability to solve global issues, whether we're talking about the existential threat of the climate crisis, or we're trying to defend this rules-based international order, we, the United States, need good partners to do it. And Europe and Germany in particular, because of our shared democratic values, because of our shared ties, are natural partners.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, but still, on the other hand, there's always criticism, and there's recently been a cry for more active participation by countries like Germany within the bounds of relationships to the United States and to multilateral accords like NATO. You mentioned the 2% GDP border, the level, or the United Nations. Would you agree that this criticism, this cry for more active participation is justified? And if so, what does the United States expect from Germany in regards of a more active participation?
Well, I mean, the United States is actually very fortunate to have an ally like Germany, who's a leader in Europe, a leader globally, who is a partner in our shared efforts to defend human rights, to strengthen democracy, to support rule of law, in our support efforts for Ukraine, like I mentioned earlier, or for Israel. So we're very fortunate to have Germany as an ally and partner like that. But at the same time, we have been asking Germany for many years to step up its commitment to collective security and to cooperation, particularly in the military sphere. Every NATO country agreed back in 2014 that it would contribute 2% of GDP to defense. And Germany has not been doing that until very recently. So that's a commitment that we expect Germany to fulfill. And really, when we talk about it, 2% is the minimum. That's kind of the floor, not the ceiling. And we see other countries that, like the United States, that see these global threats out there and say, actually, we're going to invest more than that in defense because of the threats that are out there. So we need to make sure that this commitment is sustained and sustainable, and that Europe is our natural partner for the United States for many of the global, almost all the global challenges we face around the world, really all of them. But Europe can only be a strong and contributing partner for the United States if it has strong German leadership. So we need strong German leadership inside Germany, on the European stage, in NATO, in the G7, and globally.
Well, sounds like we got to do some of our homework. Let's get back to you and your work as a diplomat. Your next assignment after you finished in Frankfurt soon, and your next assignment will be in Brussels at the European Union. Are you excited about that new challenge, or will you miss Frankfurt and Germany?
Well, I mean, it would be hard not to miss Frankfurt. I'm very much going to miss Frankfurt. It's been a fantastic 3 years here, both on a personal and a professional level. And in particular, we're going to miss many of the friendships that we made here. Fortunately, though, as you point out, we're not going very far. Brussels is only 3.5 hours away. Professionally, I'm super excited about going to Brussels. I've worked in 7 different European countries over the past 28 years. Many of those countries were former members of the Soviet Union. And in many of those countries where I worked, our embassy's goal was to help that country where I was working to prepare itself for delivering on what its citizens asked for, which was membership in a European and transatlantic future by joining the EU and joining NATO. So I'm thrilled to bring all that experience I have in these other countries in Europe to Brussels, where we're going to be working, we are working to improve U.S.-European partnership and collaboration on so many challenges that we share around the globe.
So yeah, you're excited. You're going to Brussels. And as you mentioned before, we're having the EU elections coming up. So there's going to be a lot of change in Brussels as well. But there seems to be a bit of a disillusionment by many people toward the European Union, towards those big multilateral institutions. What would you say as an American to tell those people as to why the European Union is still very, very much relevant and very important for their personal lives, in their communities, in their cities?
Well, you know, if we look back at European history, it's been marked by autocracy, feudalism, bloodshed, and strife between small nation states and city states. The developments that we've seen over the past 70 years that have led to the EU that we see today have been really been nothing short of historic. It's ushered in a period of truly historically unprecedented security, stability, and prosperity on the basis of democratic principles, protections for individual human rights and the rule of law, and fair competition based on market principles. And when we look at the challenges that we face around the world today, I mentioned the climate crisis, but then social questions like improving racial justice, promoting equality and inclusion and dignity for everyone, the European Union is and must be a powerful force in delivering solutions. So we need, I would say, young people in particular to get engaged, to vote, to advocate in their communities, and to make sure their voices are represented. You know, I'll go back to, I'm remembering my time in the Navy. On every, on every Navy ship, you have a logbook where the captain writes his daily instructions and where you record major events. But at the top of the logbook is written, "Eternal vigilance is the price of safety." And that's really based on a quote that's often attributed to Thomas Jefferson, "Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty," or you could say democracy. And so I think we have this really, we're fortunate to live in the democratic world in which we live today, but it's not historically been the kind of world that people have lived in, and we have this duty to protect it and to strengthen it. We in the United States see Europe, again, as our partner of first resort whenever it comes to the challenges of our time. And we're in a time where the decisions that we make today are going to have impact for years, perhaps even generations to come. So we face this test of our values, this test of our ability to solve these global challenges. We see authoritarian regimes challenging our democracies in a way they haven't been able to in the past. We see technological revolutions unfolding in artificial intelligence and biotechnology and advanced telecommunications, clean energy technology. And in all of those ways, the European Union has an ability to represent its citizens' interests at a much more powerful level by acting coherently and collectively than individual nation states can do in the face of some of our competitors out there that are much larger numbers-wise. So the European Union is an incredible phenomenon that Europeans should need to protect. And its ability to act as a partner with the United States in order to ensure that we together, construct a future of which we can all be proud and that's based on our democratic values, that's vital for, I'd say, the citizens of every European Union country.
I absolutely agree. And to go back to what you said about vigilancy, how important that is, you are a diplomat, and in this way, you kind of are a vigilante, not in a superhero kind of way, but in a certain way you are. But as you also said, we seem to be living in a world that's more uncertain, and wars have become more likely or more usual in a way. Have you seen a change in diplomacy and the tone of diplomacy over the span of your career? So has your part as a vigilante for your country towards other countries changed in any ways?
All right. I'm gonna push back a little bit. I want to push back a little bit on what you said there, because, I mean, you said we seem to live in this world that's a little bit more uncertain. There's more wars there. But I'm going to challenge that a little bit and
please
submit that the reality is, if you look at the data, and I guess this goes back to my background, you know, studying economics, but if you look at the data, by just about every measure that you can come up with, life today for people around the world is better than it's ever been at any point in human history. Economically, security-wise, life expectancy, by just about every measure you can come up with. But one of the things that has clearly changed is the amount of information that's out there and that floods policymakers and decision makers, and that floods our everyday citizens. And we know that our competitors and our enemies are out there using the ease of that information flow to manipulate and distort what our citizens hear. And so, you know, I think when you asked about the changes in diplomacy, I think it's what's become more valuable than ever for policy and decision makers back in Washington is to have American diplomats on the ground who can provide clear and accurate on-the-ground insights and cut through some of this information overflow and noise to get, you know, the real picture back to decision makers and policymakers. And similarly, I think that having American representatives on the ground who can go out and engage with everyday citizens across Germany to talk about our transatlantic partnership, to talk about our shared goals, to talk about what we're trying to achieve together, I think that's also more important than ever in this information overload era we live in.
Absolutely. Sir, when you will leave Germany, and with that you will also leave the Saarland, what is the one thing that you will miss the most?
So I can't pick one thing. I mean, there's a lot of different impressions and memories that I have. I'll give you a couple things, I guess. You know, one of my favorite places to visit in Southwest Germany is the Saarhunsrück National Park. And so I'm going to miss that, you know, hiking around there, gone there a couple times. Some of the museums. I mean, we talked about the museums in Washington, and but, you know, a couple of the museums in Saarland that I particularly like. The Staatsgalerie, the Moderne Gallery, the Historical Museum, which is amazing. The Völklinger Hütte, which I visited the last time I was down there for the first time, but just amazing. But in the end, you miss also some of the friendships you make. And so you mentioned Dr. von Lutz, the head of our German-American Institute there. He's been a great friend. And then some of the ministers and other business and political leaders I've met there, like the one with whom we went on our bike ride, Finance Minister
Weizsäcker. Yeah.
So I'm gonna miss the people. I'm gonna miss the natural beauty, and I'm gonna miss all the kind of cool highlights, touristic highlights, also, of course.
Yeah, but I think in Belgium you will be well set for even more touristic highlights and also very beautiful nature and landscape. Mr. Consul General, Mr. Sharp, thank you very much for taking the time and talking to me like nearly an hour now. Thank you very much, and wish you all the best of luck in Brussels. And I hope we stay in contact. Thank you for doing this podcast with me for the Union Stiftung, and all the best. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you for your support for our transatlantic partnership.
Anytime.
Bye-bye.